This is Nancy Clare. Welcome to episode 60 of Speaking of Mysteries. Our guest is Tom Bowman, whose Dry Bones in the Valley won the 2015 Edgar for Best Debut Mystery. I hadn't read it before the award was given, but I had read the other four novels in the incredibly strong field, and I figured if this won, it must be a remarkable book, and it is. After I read the book, I wanted to make sure that everyone who wanted to heard from Tom and listened to what he had to say about his protagonist, Henry Farrell, and the fictional village in rural Pennsylvania where he is a police officer. Here's Tom Bowman. Welcome back to Speaking of Mysteries. I'm delighted that our guest today is Tom Bowman, whose first book, Dry Bones in the Valley, won the Edgar for First Mystery. Welcome, Tom.
Hey, thanks, Nancy. Thanks for having me.
So congratulations for winning the Edgar. It's always an incredibly strong competitive category, and especially though this year. What does winning an Edgar, which is sort of like the Oscar of awards for mystery fiction, mean to you?
I had been the book editor, and I've gone to the Edgars a couple of times as like a publishing professional, and I thought, oh man, this is so much fun, you know. A really fun party. I was in the same room with like, you know, all of these major crime writers that I really admired. And so even to be nominated for my own little book was totally thrilling. And then to go there and, you know, what happened was my mom is a big reader of mystery fiction as well. And so when she found that out, she's like, all right, your dad and I are going too. And then I had a whole bunch of aunts and uncles also go. So I had all this family there, you know, with us. And in the moment, I was just kind of glad I won. So it was like, you know, they wouldn't go there just to be disappointed, you know. but you know, like I literally did dream about winning that. And, I still can't really believe that I have. I'm very, very, very grateful to have won it.
Well, speaking about being in the room with some of the many of the great mystery fiction writers and working today, who influenced you?
Yeah, well, you know, the thing about being an editor is you really can't read just whatever you want. You kind of have to read whatever comes across your desk for the times that you're, you know, in that job. And very, very rarely you can read a book for fun, read a book from something that you want to. I mean, in terms of influencing Dry Bones in the Valley, which takes place in this sort of quiet rural area, when I was younger, like in my teens and 20s, I read a lot of James Lee Burke, you know, the Dave Robichaux series, mm-hmm. and really loved that. And kind of fell off because, like I said, you know, I was working in book publishing, wasn't free just to read whatever I wanted. I grew up even before that, and I'm not sure how much of an influence this series was, but the Travis McGee series by John D. MacDonald, I really loved that. A Purple Place for Dying and, you know, Bright Orange for the Shroud, all those books with the colors in their titles. I really loved the first-person voice and the kind of rebelliousness of those books. And but really, the one book that kind of stands out for me that's more recent than any of that is Thomas French's In the Woods. I managed to read that, and I thought, oh, man, this is amazing that that she can leave so much kind of hanging, you know, so much unresolved in a way. And it's more powerful because she's done that. And so I guess that, you know, among many others, you know, not in the mystery world, Larry Brown had a big influence on me.
Some of the greats in sort of a disparate group, which, you know, I can see sort of came together in as an influence, which kind of brings me to the next question. When I met you after the Edgars, your editor described Dry Bones in the Valley to me as a literary mystery. And I think that term means something different to almost everyone who hears it. And I'm wondering, what does the term literary mystery mean to you? And do you think Dry Bones in the Valley is a literary mystery?
Well, if it is one, it's sort of one accidentally. I definitely did set out to write just a straight-ahead mystery. I think that people have characterized it as a literary mystery because I maybe spent more time than is customary in the genre on descriptions of place and character and things like that that don't necessarily always propel the plot forward. I think that may be the quality that people kind of latch onto as defining of a literary mystery. I didn't mean to write one. I'm happy to have written one. to me, I wanted to write a mystery, and I'm just glad that Norton published it, that Norton's my publisher. And part of that may be that they just don't publish that many mysteries. They do some crime fiction, not that much. They're much more of a literary house. So to them, they might want to focus more on those qualities, those sort of qualities that they have in common with just sort of mainstream fiction, literary fiction. Does that make sense?
It makes sense. I mean, I think when I read the book, I didn't read it until after I met you, and I found just a lyricism in it. And to me, that is literary fiction. Strangely, it's almost an audible thing where there's music to the words, and often, and we'll get to this later in the interview, music is integrated into the context of the story, as it is with Dry Bones in the Valley. You didn't set out to write a literary mystery, but at its core, Dry Bones is a murder mystery, and actually two murder mysteries that are possibly linked, possibly not. But it's more than that. It's a pretty impartial examination of ecological concerns versus financial concerns for a depressed region. And why did you decide on that particular backdrop?
Where the book takes place is in northeastern Pennsylvania, in the sort of northeastern area of the Marcellus Shale Formation. And that's where a lot of the high-volume hydrofracking is going on, sort of unconventional drilling for natural gas. And that's where, the operators will drill way down into this rock formation and then sideways and then shoot a bunch of fluid at high pressure to fracture the rock and release the gas. And, of course, that's just a very, very basic description of the process. But almost anybody would recognize the term fracking and know that it's kind of controversial. I grew up right on the sweet spot of the Marcellus Shale up there in northeastern Pennsylvania in a very rural place and there were landsmen going around making deals with people to lease their gas rights. And, it was like a matter of some serious concern to me because I thought, like this place where my family still lives that I love and so quiet and beautiful is going to be transformed much for the worse. So I was thinking about that and worrying about that really a lot as I was formulating the book, and that made it into the book in a fairly big way, not as big as I had maybe initially imagined. But, essentially I was just writing about my home where I grew up. And, it's a fictional county in northeastern Pennsylvania, in my book, in a fictional town in that county. But it bears a lot of resemblance to where I grew up. So it was familiar to me. There was this strong feeling of sort of anxiety about the fate of the place. I almost couldn't avoid writing about that in a way.
Your protagonist, Henry Ferrell, is a young widower, and I see parallels in his struggle to reconcile what happened to him and what's happening with your fictional town, Wild Thyme, where he serves as a police officer. Is that a fair assessment, or am I reading too much into this?
No, that's fair. I mean, it's fiction, so of course things get exaggerated and, one focuses on certain things, not on others and whatever else, but I was really became obsessed with this process and the kind of harm that it could do, certain people and landscapes and environments and everything. And so there's a strong suggestion in the book that Henry Ferrell's life essentially was through contact with air pollution, water pollution, developed cancer, and that's how she dies. So there's that connection. I don't I don't say it explicitly, but yeah, you're absolutely right to notice that.
Well, you know, it seems that that's the connection in his mind, that they made it. The book is a lot of the book is about compromise, the compromise that Henry and his bride made to buy the house where they bought, the compromises that the people of your county and Wildthyme are making. And I thought you took a very impartial, you didn't come down on one side or the other. These are very, very tough choices that people have to make about money versus pristine landscape.
Well, yeah, that's thank you for saying that. That's really what I tried to do. I wasn't, I was obviously, like I said, I was, you know, worried about the effects this industrial development would have on the area. But the way I wrote about the book is reflective of the attitudes that I encounter up there, and in some extent my own. Like, before it really arrived en masse, it was like, it was easy to imagine the worst possible case scenario. In fact, it's been quieter than that. There have been some problems, but generally speaking, it's been quiet, and people up there are more or less content to have the extra money. I mean, there are sort of farms and people with lots of land that really could use the help, you know, to keep that land, you know, open and not, you know, develop it in other ways. And that's one of the good things that that the natural gas industry has. It's one of the good effects it's had. So it's not, you know, I meet people that are 100% anti-fracking, you know, and I don't think that's as nuanced a view as I've encountered among the people that are actually in it. And, yeah, but so that's what I tried to do with the book. I wanted to acknowledge that not everybody, you know, is so very alarmist about this. And,
well, like everything else, it's complicated. C.J. Box wrote a mystery where he talks about the wind industry. And it wasn't a polemic, but he pointed out that it's not as simple and as elegant as people, those of us who live in cities and our power just sort of comes to us, you know, when we flip the switch. It's a little more complicated than that, and it's much more complicated for the people who live in the vicinity of
this. Yeah, that's, I mean, I haven't read that book, but I read C.J. Box's first book, and I like that one a lot. I'll pick that one up, it sounds good.
Music, and specifically the music of the region, runs through this book, Dry Bones in the Valley. Henry Farrell is a fiddle player. And it seems to me that he uses playing fiddle with others to rebuild his connection to humanity, and I'm assuming that was intentional. What role does music play in the narrative of the book?
It's another one of those things that I'm kind of obsessed with, so it sort of had to make it into the book in some way or another. I'm really fascinated by older music, older American music, and the connections it has with music from other places. To me, that kind of music, you know, old fiddle tunes, old songs with sort of half-remembered lyrics and whatnot, that's just, I love it. You know, I'm endlessly sort of drawn to it. And to me, to keep that music alive is a kind of a form of resurrection, and it's also a form of communication. I mean, if you're making music with people, you're in a sort of realm beyond, in a way. You can already, not always, but you can get there by collaborating with people musically. And I've always felt that. I've been in a couple bands, and I play music with my wife all the time, and so it's a very important part of my life. And I just thought, let's give Henry that too, because you know, it makes me happy. I want to make him happy, and in a way, it's sort of connected to me the sort of the old kind of half forgotten music being revived, the old songs being remembered. It connects in my mind to old stories coming back, and don't expect. That from a dad or from a new place or wherever. So all that was kind of swirling around in my mind when I was writing about it. It's gonna be even a more constant presence in the upcoming books, I think.
Oh, well, don't get too ahead of yourself, because that's a couple of questions down the line. Certainly your protagonist has, the usual sort of conflicted relationships with the state police, and there's always a budget crunch, and because in spite of the increasing wealth in the county, he's still under some economic constraints of, how to distribute the limited resources they have, both in manpower and money, in investigation. And, I thought you handled that really well, and I found that really interesting. I could feel his frustration. He was not a police officer investigating a crime with unlimited resources. Like, he had to sort of pick and choose how he was going to approach things, and I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that's fairly ubiquitous in law enforcement, and in smaller towns, certainly that's true. I mean, they're just not set up to investigate major crimes, and very often it involves a great deal of forensics, or if a more far-ranging investigation, the state police will come in and help out. I think that's pretty common. I think culturally there's an idea that a police isn't even necessary in a town of that size, because people are more or less self-sufficient and can take care of themselves. And so that was one of the things I wanted to kind of get kind of butt up against a little bit, the idea that, in a way, he doesn't have very many resources because, in part, he's not entirely wanted, and people may not understand what it is that he does or is capable of doing. I think that's pretty common, especially in small town law enforcement, which is not half enough of what you need,
It seems to me that he needed the resources. What I liked was he needed the resources of the state for their technical prowess, but he was frustrated because he understood the people. They didn't. It was just, I thought that was a good way of demonstrating what you were talking about, that a small town is basically self-sufficient. People that live in the small town generally know all of the players and probably what their roles are going to be. The state experts might confuse their technical expertise with expertise in everything.
That's certainly a possibility, and I did kind of intend for Henry to be a part of that community. His upbringing is very, very rural. He grew up, hunting, basically, to put food on the table from an early age, and I wanted him to, there to be no real separation between him and anybody else in the community, be they a well-to-do person or, a reprobate, really. I mean, he's just it. And I think what I intended, or maybe came to realize, is that the way he would get through the particular things that put him through in the book was to accept that he was sort of one and the same with these people in the community, and that that would help, that understanding would help him sort of get through it in a way that people who came in from the outside wouldn't necessarily benefit from that, or even be interested in it. So.
Well, you hinted at this earlier, that you're working on a second novel. I'm hoping that Henry is coming back. And is there anything you can tell us about it?
Sure. Yeah, I have two more in the series under contract, and I'm working on the second one. And the way I had imagined the series is sort of roughly divided up by cities, and not necessarily seasons all in the same year. In fact, they're not going to be in the same year. They might skip a few years here or there, or whatever. But this first one, as snowy as it was, that was a springtime book. That book began on the first day of spring and moved forward into the spring. The book I'm working on now is a summertime book. It's going to be more fun. for Henry, I think, in a way. He's going to be a slightly happier person. He'll have some romances. And things will sort of get him out of his shell. The crime is a disappearance. And it's going to span 2 summers. It's going to take 2 summers to sort of figure everything out. And, yeah, that's where I'm at so far. That's what I can tell you about it. I'm having fun writing it.
Any idea of the pub date?
No, we're not at that stage yet. But it shouldn't be too long before we figure that out.
I gotta
finish the book first before we, get all that stuff.
I hope so, because he's a very engaging guy. He's very interesting, and he's the kind of character that readers would want to know more about. He's definitely not a one-dimensional character. There's a lot to Henry, and even when you're reading the first book in the series, you can see that there's a lot more in there that if you're curious, you would want to know about.
Well, thank you very much for saying that. I just wanted to be happy. The first book is so melancholy, you know what I mean? I wanted just to take 4 books and essentially make him a happy, well-adjusted.
Heal him. Tom, thank you so much for your time. I know that this probably took time away from writing, and I really appreciate it. And I look forward to the next book, and I hope that you'll come back on the show to talk about it.
I would be delighted, and I'm very happy to talk to you about this book, and thank you so much for having me on the show.
Next week, we have an interview with Martin Walker about The Patriarch, his latest Bruno Chief of Police mystery, as well as an interview with Kelly Stanley about all the Miranda Corby noir mysteries, including her most recent City of Ghosts. This is Nancy Clare. Thank you again for listening to Speaking of Mysteries.